Honoring Connecticut's educators, it's Teacher Appreciation Week. Melissa in the Morning, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
How in the world could I kick off Teacher Appreciation Week without one of my favorites, Fran Rabinowitz, back on the show, the Executive Director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents and one of my education specialists here on the morning show. Fran, happy Teacher Appreciation Week. I appreciate you and the fact that you come on this show so often. How are you?
Oh, Melissa, thank you so much. You're so kind. And I am thrilled to be on the show. I think you ask the right questions and you focus on the right things for us to move our kids to be very successful. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that, Fran. We're going to get right into sort of the report card of Connecticut's teachers and looking at how our state is doing, whether we're doing things right or not right, or maybe a little bit of both. Let's start with the big elephant in the room that we've been trying to address for quite some time now, which is recruitment and retention. How are we doing in Connecticut with that?
Well, I think that we have to put it into the perspective of the national picture. And the national picture is pretty bleak. You know, I have a counterpart in every state, and they tell me how horrific it is. Do I think it's good in Connecticut? No, I am really very, very concerned. I'll just give you one number. I co-chair the state special ed task force. And I surveyed Connecticut and all the districts. 92 responded out of 169, which encompassed about half of the students in Connecticut. And there were 222 openings for special ed teachers.
Wow.
So I have to say I am incredibly concerned about that.
Well, and Fran, we've noticed, even you and I have talked about this, that paraprofessionals, for example, those jobs are cut so quickly. It's amazing.
Oh, it is amazing. And in that same survey, I found out we were short. This was just special ed paraprofessionals, 650.
650 openings?
Openings for paraprofessionals.
What the heck is going on?
Honestly, Melissa, we are in... I try to stay very calm, and I try to say we've got to face this and move on. But I have to say there is a real urgency with this, and there is the admitting that the nation as a whole is in crisis with this, but we are certainly part of that nation.
So Fran Rabinowitz is the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, but Fran also has a very lengthy background in education. She's even worked here in Bridgeport. She's been a principal before, so she's been an educator in a lot of different sectors. Fran, when did this start, though? I think a lot of times people look to the pandemic. Was this a problem before the pandemic?
Yes, it was a problem before the pandemic. The issue is, you know, when I was interim superintendent for 3 years in Bridgeport, and I spent the better part of my career there, I can tell you, we were suffering with, you know, staff shortages 10, 15 years ago in specific areas, such as special ed, such as math and science. But now it's the suburbs and the rurals that are all saying, you know, they're having major issues. Mm. Certainly, it's still the worst in the urban districts, but it has spread throughout the state. And even if there aren't openings in some of the districts, they're saying that their pool of candidates is very shallow.
Mm. So what's the deal then, Fran? Does this really come down to pay? Is it conditions? A little bit of both? Like, I mean, the fact that it's even a rural issue, that's terrible.
Yeah, Melissa, it's a little of both. You know, Kate Diaz, who's president of the CEA, mm-hmm. She and I talk a whole lot. And, you know, I do believe it is salaries. I think that is one piece. But I think the other piece is working conditions. And certainly, you know, I have an urban perspective from having been in Bridgeport and Hamden, to be honest. And at the state as associate commissioner, I dealt often with the Irvins, and I would say we have to face the fact that the conditions there are not terrific. They really aren't. And when I did exit interviews as an interim superintendent, I found out that, you know, some of the people would, some of the teachers that were leaving the district would say to me, yes, Fran, I'm going to make more money, but that's not why I'm leaving. You don't have the conditions in place to make me feel successful every day. I have a large class size. I don't have interventionists to work with the children. And I want to feel successful, and I can't blame them. So I do think it's some of both.
Yeah, and when you talk about the conditions too, Fran, I haven't noticed it as much in the rural areas, but I have friends who teach in Stamford, Norwalk, not just Bridgeport, and they all have to do these like materials lists. They have like wish lists. I think it's the most bizarre thing I've ever heard in my entire life. I've never heard of a career where you are paid to do a job and yet you need to pay out of your pocket to do that job. It is very weird to me. Like, that just seems so beyond backwards. I don't know how we're living in 2023 where teachers are trying to ask and beg people for money so they could get new materials for their new classes every single year. That is so messed up, is the best way I could put it.
You are so on the mark. I'm going to tell you, I started teaching in Bridgeport in the 70s. Can you believe that? And I was buying materials then, and nothing has changed.
That's insane. That's crazy.
I made, just as teachers today, I made very little money. I think, you know, I mean, way back then when I started, I think I was making $7,000. And I spent a fortune every year on materials. I didn't have scissors. I didn't have crayons. I didn't have paints. I didn't have any of those things. And, you know, I would buy bookcases at Goodwill and paint them and bring them to my classroom. And I'm going to tell you, the thing that is discouraging is teachers are still having to do that today. Now, you don't have to do that in Westport or Simsbury, but in Norwalk, in Stamford, in Bridgeport, yes, the teachers are doing that. And I'm talking about conditions. We all want our kids to feel good about coming to the classroom. We want them to be bright and cheerful and inviting and engaging. And if you want to do that, you've got to buy your own materials.
That's just so beyond unacceptable. I mean, that just is so ridiculous. And obviously, it's something that even you had to go through, Fran, so long ago, and that it's still going on today is just, I don't know. Every time I see those wish lists come out in the, like, you know, in the summertime, because, you know, like I said, I see them for my friends, my family members. My sister-in-law is a teacher up in Worcester, Mass, and she's got it too. And I'm like, these city teachers especially have wish lists. And I think this is just so, I've never heard of a career where it's like, we're going to pay you to do a job, but if you want to do your job correctly, you have to pay for your materials. That is just asinine.
And it's going
it's insane.
And you know, my thing is, you know, why not? I mean, our teachers are our greatest treasure. They are our professionals. In my book, I believe that you ought to take your budget and whatever you're buying in materials or whatever that you think are important in central office, stop and bring in the teachers and give them each an allotment for their classroom to purchase the materials they think they need. We need to trust them to be the professionals that they are and to purchase what they feel is in the best needs of their kids. I mean, I've been saying that forever. I said it during ESSER funding. That's what we need to do.
We have Fran Rabinowitz here, the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. We're talking about the report card of teachers, recruitment and retention here in Connecticut. And it's not the worst, but it's certainly nothing to write home about. It's a problem. We've been having an issue, but so has the rest of the nation. And Fran has been a real champion of investing in our teachers, going above and beyond to give them the best conditions, especially in our city schools. and making sure that we don't lose great teachers or great educators for our kids and for the future. Fran, let's also look at what a teacher's role is in 2023. I think sometimes if people haven't had their kids enrolled in quite some time, they don't even really know why there's a teacher shortage. Like, why? You know, in my day, people just worked. You just worked. Why isn't that the case today? Why aren't people just working? You know, what's happening that teachers don't really look the same as what they were even 10, 20 years ago?
Oh, you know, great question. I'm going to tell you that when I came to teaching, I came to teach children to read mathematics, science, social studies, and, you know, create wonderful conditions for learning. Today, we really have to focus on the whole child more than ever before. They come to us with many, many issues. I mean, some have suffered trauma prior to coming to school, but all of them need the social and emotional development of that we sort of took for granted in the past, and it isn't there. How to get along with each other, how to recognize and look at your feelings, how to regulate your feelings, how to step back from a situation. All of that is incredibly important. We also have to take care of all of those children who may not be meeting our rigorous standards and figure out how to tutor them, how to intervene with them, and at the same time, how to be in touch with families that many of whom are doing all they can to make ends meet. You know, some of them have two and three jobs. And I'm not talking just about the cities. I'm talking rural, and I'm talking in some suburban as well, so that you're looking at before school care, after school care. You're coordinating that with schools. That is very different from having kids come in at 8:45 and leave at 3. It's a whole different ballgame today.
Mm-hmm. And Fran, I know earlier this year, the State Department of Education decided to take some new steps to address the concerns we have with teacher retention and recruitment. Two new initiatives. One is improving the teacher certification test and changing the way educators are evaluated. And I know these initiatives are kind of in the early stages right now, but they're supposed to be implemented by the 2024-25 school year. So not this upcoming new school year, but the next. Do you think it'll make a really, like, a big difference? Do you think that will attract new teachers to Connecticut? Or people who currently are kind of in the wings waiting to get into that career? Or do you think that's not really hitting the bullseye on this problem?
I think it's one of the many factors. I served on the Teacher Eval Committee. It's just, we have a draft process ready to go. We have it will be approved hopefully by the state board in early June. The legislature has a bill in. Let's face it, Melissa, the 2012 teacher eval plan that I fought against very strongly was a bust. I mean, it didn't do anything for us, and it didn't professionalize and support and develop teachers. I believe that this plan is one which is very interactive between the evaluator and the evaluatee, that it's learning on both ends. And I love the plan. I really do. I am also going to sit on the certification committee, and I believe we can streamline it. I believe that we can look at the testing that we do for our candidates for teaching, and at the same time, not ever think about lowering standards. I mean, it's time for Connecticut to understand that teachers that come from other states are well certified to teach with us and not make them go through many tests. And I'll just give you one quick example. When I was associate commissioner, a superintendent came in from another state. That superintendent had been responsible for the special ed department in their state, in district, but they did not have a specific course in special ed that Connecticut required. They had to go back to and take that course in order to get certified.
That's ridiculous. That just turns people off when they're clearly overqualified, if not qualified for that job. Yeah.
Absolutely, Melissa. So am I happy we're looking at that? Yes. I think the State Department of Ed has really gotten on board and is really working very diligently on that, as well as working diligently on increasing the diversity in our teaching force, which is essential for our kids.
Yeah, no question. Well, Fran, I thank you for the work that you do at the state and local level, of course, the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. Thank you for this report card update. I think it's so important for people to know, especially going into Teacher Appreciation Week and really valuing the people who are teaching our children and our next generation and who taught us, and realizing that there are some major issues that still need to get worked out here in Connecticut in order to get that workforce into a healthy place and assure that we're going to give our kids the best future possible. So thank you for this information. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. It's always a pleasure.
You asked the
right question.
Aw, Fran, thank you. Well, I appreciate you, and you are always welcome here. And I, again, reiterate, thank you for what you do. Really, I appreciate you. Thank you.
Not much, Melissa, but I try.
Well, you succeed.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Fran Rabinowitz, again, Executive Director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents here on WICC. So we are supporting our teachers and saying thank you all week long with some interesting stories. And this one I was lucky enough to come across while I was at a retreat a few weeks back. I met Kim, and Kim works in the Trumbull School District, and she is a tutor for homebound tutoring, which I had never heard of before. And so I wanted to have Kim be part of this week's coverage because I think it's really neat what Trumbull's doing. And I hope if there are districts out there not actively doing something like this, they'll consider it. So welcome to the show. Kim Zents, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Melissa.
I'm so glad to have you here, Kim. So first of all, how long have you been an educator?
I have been an educator for probably about 20 years now in a variety of different ways. I was a classroom high school biology teacher in upstate New York for a while, and I've done tutoring in a variety of ways for probably 15 years.
Amazing. So when did you get here into Connecticut and start working with Trumbull?
We moved to Trumbull about 6 years ago, and I started working for the district, I believe, in 2019.
Okay. So what is homebound tutoring? If people were to ask that, how do you describe the program you're part of?
We work with students who, for a variety of reasons, have been unable to attend school for at least 10 consecutive days, and they are experiencing usually a medical issue that prevents them from being in school. And so with a note from their doctor, the district starts to work and coordinate a program, and they pair them up with tutors like myself who are certified in different areas, and we work with those students usually at their home or sometimes at the library, depending on the situation, and we coordinate with their classroom teachers and help them complete the work that they would be doing normally in school.
Is homebound tutoring only for like high schoolers, or is this K through 12?
That's a good question. I believe it does work with students K through 12. I particularly work with middle school and high school students.
Oh, wow.
Because of my certification.
That's amazing. So what is that like? Like, walk me through this, Kim. So let's say we've got a student, for whatever reason, they've either gotten a diagnosis where they've got to get a lot of treatments, or maybe they were in some kind of an accident where they broke several bones and they just can't make it to school consecutively. So they've fallen behind. They contact you. They say, hey, Kim, we've got this student. We've got little Gregory, who's just struggling to get to class, and we've got to, for the next 3 months, keep him on track. What happens next?
Yeah, so I receive the information from my supervisor, and then I reach out to the family and let them know who I am and that I'm going to be working with them, with their child. And then I also reach out to their classroom teachers and get the work from that teacher. And then I meet with the student, and we do 2 hours per subject per week for the middle school and high school kids. I tutor science and math with students sometimes, and so I meet with them, up to 4 hours a week if it's 2 subjects, and just help them in the best way I can to understand the material. And I really enjoy being able to make personal connections. These kids are all going through a difficult time, and it's absolutely my privilege to be able to connect with them, help them understand the content that they are unable to attend school and learn there.
I think this is very cool, Kim. And I know we've talked about this several times since we first met a few weeks back, but I love that Trumbull does this. Do you know if other schools, I know you personally work in Trumbull, but is this something right. that other school districts have in place?
I don't know for sure, but my guess is that they do have something like this in place. I'm sure that every district deals with students, you know, who have similar situations to what you've described, and they have to accommodate them in some way. And I wouldn't be surprised if they have, but I don't know for sure exactly what they do.
So I'm curious, we're talking to Kim Zentz this morning, who is one of the tutors for homebound tutoring, which is done through the Trumbull School District. Essentially, if a student is out of school for at least 10 consecutive days, gets a note from a doctor saying, hey, you know, there are some kids who maybe, for example, were diagnosed with Lyme disease and they're going through a lot of treatments and they're too weak to go to class. But they want to be able to, I don't want to say graduate on time, but they want to be able to advance and continue on with like right. going to the next grade or whatever. Yes. This is an opportunity for them to do that at home or like at a public library. On average, Kim, because I know everybody has different stories, but could you be with a student for an entire year? Is it usually like 3 months? Like, what do you typically see when you get different cases?
It can be a variety. I have had sometimes students who are kind of coming back out of a hospital stay and are at home for a few weeks and on their way back to school. Or sometimes I have had students for a good chunk of the year
wow.
Who are experiencing a significant issue. Yes.
That's amazing. And then is this only for the academic year, or can Trumbull say to you, hey, this student was able to complete sixth grade, go to seventh grade, but they really are not at the level they should be for science, and we'd love to contract you to work with them all summer long. Like, do you do summer school as well, or is this just for the academic year?
It's primarily for the academic year.
Okay.
A couple times I have had a student I've been working with, we've been unable to finish the academic year material, and I've gone into the summer to try to catch them up and finish that class. But typically it's just the academic year.
Do you miss being in a classroom versus going one-on-one to people's homes or into the library?
Actually, I honestly prefer working in small groups with students, or in this case, one-on-one with students. Mm. That's always been my favorite part of education, like connecting with the student, helping them to specifically understand the material that I'm teaching them. So I love it. I really enjoy doing this.
Well, and I think there has to be a sense of satisfaction too, Kim, because you get to see like the beginning and end, if you will. I was just talking to a former teacher of mine, because I'm doing a segment later this week talking to former teachers all the way back to my elementary school days as kind
Aww.
Of like a joke. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And when I was talking to one of these teachers, I said to him, I'm like, you have no idea the impact you've had on me 20 years later. And he said, I had no idea. Like, I had no idea. And I think about, well, I was in a classroom of 20 kids. So how would you really know? Like, how would you know, versus in your situation, you're doing one-on-one, so you are seeing the growth in that student, you're hearing the comments or the feedback from them or the parents, and it's like that satisfaction as a teacher, I think a lot of teachers in classes probably don't get to have as much as they would like to, because
yes.
you're dealing with an entire classroom.
Right, that's absolutely true. It is very rewarding to, you know, I interact with the parents probably more than most teachers get to, and to see that student one-on-one and see their progress, you know, and, you know, the idea is to get them back into their regular classroom as soon as possible. And it is very rewarding to see that.
Well, Kim, you've definitely inspired me to ask my son's school district what they do in this instance, because I love that Trumbull has homebound tutoring. I think this is such an amazing concept. It keeps kids motivated and from falling behind. I mean, you already have so many stresses on your plate when it comes to your health or whatever it is that's mm-hmm. getting in the way. And to have this option as the public school district for Trumbull, I just think is brilliant. So I thank you for being a part of it and for coming on and sharing it with us today.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. welcome. Thank you for highlighting it and for highlighting teachers this week.
Absolutely. And thank you for your time, Kim. Really, really appreciate it. Kim Zents here on WICC, and this is homebound tutoring done through the Trumbull Public School District. Definitely curious if this is done here in Milford, which is the district that my son is part of. And if you have questions about it, it might be worth you reaching out to your school district to see how do you handle these situations if my child ends up needing that one-on-one to make sure that they complete that school year that they're in the middle of. Very interesting. Way to go, Trumbull.
We're actually coming up on the two-year anniversary since the University of Bridgeport had a new future thanks to Goodwin University. Goodwin announced back in May of 2021 the completion of its acquisition of the majority of academic programs and real estate that makes up the University of Bridgeport. Now, UB still functions as an independent institution, but it has the leadership and the board of trustees under the ownership and operation of Goodwin University. And I came across one of the assistant professors at Goodwin a few weeks ago, and I learned that some new courses are coming to Bridgeport students for the very first time, including welding, which to me sounded like sort of an old art being made new. So I'm excited to have here Assistant Professor of Welding and Fabrication at Goodwin University. Jason Sagassi is here. And good morning to you, Jason. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
So, Jason, first of all, tell us a little bit about the work that you do. Welding and fabrication, what is that?
Yeah, so welding fabrication is about taking metal and forming it into many of the things that we use in our daily lives. Our civilization is made possible by our use of metal in everything around us. Just, I mean, if you're listeners out there, just look around, just right around you, and I'm sure you'll see many things that are fabricated from metal in your home, business, your car, airplane, what have you. And metal is formed by two ways. So we have an additive way of making things, which is welding, which is taking different parts and we put them together. Another way is machining, which is taking larger blocks of metal and sort of carving them away. You can imagine like a block of clay, and then you just sort of carve away what you don't need into the parts that you do. So these two methods are two sides of the same coin that form everything around us. And welding is more than just, say, welding up buildings or trucks or vehicles or things like that, but also encompasses things as diverse as, of course, aircraft, ships. A lot of medical components are welded together, like a lot of very small dental and metal implants in the human body are hand welded together. Furniture, you've got a lot of like architectural things, lamps, decorative stuff, furniture. I built dining tables and bathroom vanities for people, bicycles. And we'll talk about repair. Another big plus for welding is that anything that's made of metal eventually is going to break at some point. Welding enables us to put things back together. So instead of, say, scrapping a truck that might be broken or a piece of furniture, well, we could weld it back together instead of scrapping it and causing more waste and filling up our landfills. We could bring older things a new life and bring them back. So one of the things I love about welding is that not only can we create new things, but we have the ability to repair older things and give them a new life or maybe even change them into something else and continue that process. So metal is endlessly recyclable, which is a really nice thing for me. I really like that. You know, we don't generate waste.
Yeah.
It's a closed loop.
It's very innovative for sure. I have to say something though, Jason, and I really hope that you don't take offense to this. When I first met and you told me that you did welding and you're bringing welding to Bridgeport for college students, I was like, really? Okay. To me, I don't know why, but welding just seems like one of those old school workforce industries. Like I feel like you would see a welder at like old Sturbridge Village. I know that sounds really awful, but like it's just one of those where I feel like that's been around for a very long time. But it sounds to me like you're saying there are still a lot of people who actively love this industry, and it's still going.
Oh, very much so. So things like Yes, like, you know, blacksmiths make doing stuff with horseshoes or making simple tools at a like a historical village or something. That is part of our history. Working metal, welding, and blacksmithing goes back to the Iron Age. I mean, that's why it's called the Iron Age.
It goes
back to the earliest parts of human history and civilization. So we have a very, very deep history as an industry, very deep history. In the modern times, welding, it occupies a place in our civilization where, I mean, I think most famously, and a lot of listeners will be familiar with Mike Rowe and his Dirty Jobs program that aired some years ago. A lot of the work we do supports civilization. You know, I like to tell my students, when we do our job at the very best, we are invisible. Nobody sees us. You know, people go about their daily lives like nothing happened, and that's the way it should be. So a lot of what we do underpins civilization: bridges, overpasses, factories, buildings. You know, the inside workings of your car or truck, or the inside workings of an aircraft, or maybe the cruise ship you're taking on vacation with your family. If everything works perfectly, nothing breaks, the airplane doesn't fall out of the sky, the ship, you know, everything works as it should. And so people never really notice. It's a very quiet thing. And that's okay. You know, it's nice to look at that. And I think it's a very nice thing that many of the students I have coming to the program really appreciate. You know, it's not flashy. You know, there's a quiet solidity to the work we do. Mm. And there's a lot of pride in the work we do. That, you know, yeah, people don't notice it, but they're like, yeah, you know, I built that bridge. You know, I built that building.
Right.
And these office workers never notice, but they benefit from the work and my skill.
We are doing Teacher Appreciation Week here on WICC, and I am so glad to have Jason Sagassi here, an assistant professor of welding and fabrication at Goodwin University, bringing these teachings here to the University of Bridgeport. So tell us, Jason, bring me inside the classroom. If I am a student of yours, what will I be learning? What does that look like to be in a class for welding and fabrication?
Well, that's a very, very good question, because, again, this is going to clarify a lot of people's understanding of, like, what it is we do. So for students, our classes are not very big. We're limited to 14 students. So that's kind of nice, not too big, not too small. It's an eight-month program, so it doesn't take forever. So the first thing that we cover in the program is safety. So a big one is our world of industrial work is a very different world from your everyday world that most people know. So the first part of the program is students learn about how do we act, how do we work, how do we understand the industrial environment that is like it could be a large factory, a large production facility like Electric Boat up in Groton, or it could be a very small shop of that maybe just of three or four people. But they're both the same, with the same kind of dangers of, you know, tools and how to understand about, you know, a fire, putting out a fire, what things can catch on fire, safety around electrical systems, various types of power tools. But a big part of our program that is notable and really brings welding into the modern era and the future is we put a very big emphasis on learning how to read what are called technical drawings, prints. So for people out there and say, well, I've heard of what a blueprint is, but I really don't know what it is. If anybody's ever gone to IKEA and you get your furniture that comes in the flat pack and you get that manual that has all the pictures of like the little people with tools showing how to put it together, that is a print. And a print is just an instruction to make something. Same thing as a recipe in a book. If you're making a cake or a pie or a roast chicken, a recipe is instructions to make something. It's a print. So students learn this kind of language. It was really the language of industry, making anything from a house to furniture to an aircraft to a submarine all starts with a drawing. Here are the parts. Here's how they go together. And this is the language you need to learn. So that's a very big component of something we emphasize throughout the program. And it's one of the things that a lot of local businesses have noted about what we teach and our students, that they know how to read prints, and that's really an essential component of modern metalworking. And it's what enables welding to do more than just, you know, blacksmithing horseshoes, but to build satellites, for instance, or prosthetic limbs for people so they can walk again or something.
Yeah, I mean, the possibilities are, it just seems endless. And Jason, before we run out of time, I was curious, why bring it to Bridgeport? You know, what do you find with your current students, you know, to that you feel will probably happen as well right here in Bridgeport? Like, why bring this course to UB?
Well, I actually started my teaching career in Bridgeport many, many years ago.
Oh, no kidding.
And I live right next door to it as well. I mean, I was in the public school system for a while teaching. I actually started in teaching art, but still it's a creative field, and I build sculpture with metal now, so it's very related. But Bridgeport, because when you look at the program, right now we're up in East Hartford, which is, you know, pretty far away from Bridgeport. And Bridgeport has a very rich history of industry. And in fact, the shipyard area, the harbor of Bridgeport, has been undergoing a lot of developments in the last couple of years. There's a lot of stuff going on down there. There are lots and lots of businesses all along the coast that do all different kinds of fabrication. And the one thing that's been missing is there hasn't been anywhere for people to learn this skill. For many years, when people find out I teach this stuff all over down here, they come up and go, hey, you know, do you do private classes or anywhere I can learn this stuff? Mm-hmm. I just had a construction company redoing my driveways a couple of weeks ago. And when the workers found out I teach welding, they're like, oh, wow, we'd really love to learn welding. There's nowhere for us to learn this skill, which is really true. There is nowhere on the southern part of the state that teaches welding and fabrication.
That's amazing.
Being as such an essential component of industry in our state, it's a shame that there hasn't been an option for people that want to learn this thing. So
true.
Placing it in Bridgeport will make an option for people all over the southern part of Connecticut to be able to learn this skill. And what's really wonderful about it is that I've seen so many students, young people, older people that, you know, have worked at jobs or done things. And they're like, you know, I'm not really doing anything that brings me satisfaction. This is interesting to me. I can't really find my place. And it's wonderful to see so many of my students that over the course of 8 months have blossomed and grown into people that are very passionate about what they do, and they really love it. And the success stories down the road have really been wonderful to see. You know, there are other options for life. Welding and fabrication, you know, you can make a comfortable income, but the greater part of this, I believe, is that the job satisfaction is tremendous. You know, to do a job where at the end of every day, you know, you've actually done something, that I have built something, I have made something.
It is. It's so physically pleasing, I would think.
Yeah. It's a combination of a very intense physical movement and mental movement. You have mind, body, spirit all in action at 100%. And that's very rare in jobs. It really is. You know?
It really is, Jason. I mean, I even look at this job that I do, and while it is very fulfilling, you don't see at the end of the day like, oh, well, you know, what did this show do? Like, I don't get to physically hold this show in my hands. I could share it, of course, you know, over a podcast, but I don't get to physically hold something that's like, wow, I built this. I built this show, and I get to look at it. I get to put it on my shelf, and I get to go, wow, you did that. There are not a lot of jobs that allow you to do that, and welding is definitely something that is so inspirational, and it just doesn't have an end to it, which is really neat as well. So, Jason, I want to thank you for the work that you do at Goodwin University and that you will be bringing to the University of Bridgeport as early as the fall of this upcoming, you know, this next academic year. So thank you for what you do, Assistant Professor of Welding and Fabrication at Goodwin University. And I look forward to seeing what students have to say once they enter your classes right here in Bridgeport. Jason Sagassi here on WICC. We appreciate you for Teacher Appreciation Week. I am so excited to have this, I'm going to call her a superstar teacher right here in Connecticut. We have 2023's Teacher of the Year here in Connecticut and also finalist for the 2023 National Teacher of the Year Award, and that is Carolyn Kelma. Carolyn, welcome to the show. Happy Teacher Appreciation Week. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much. I'm doing well.
Tell us, first of all, Carolyn, what type of education are you into? I know, obviously, you're with Bristol. You're in the Bristol School District. So what is it that you do?
Yes, I teach high school science at Bristol Eastern High School and the Bristol Public Schools. I teach biology, biotechnology, and forensics.
Why do you love the sciences? What got you into that sector of teaching?
I was always a real curious child, and I really had amazing science teachers growing up who kind of sparked my curiosity and kept me interested and also kind of allowed me to just kind of explore and create with science. And so I think that spurred me on.
How long have you been a teacher, Carolyn?
21 years.
Wow. Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you so much.
Does it feel like it flew by, though? Like, you always hear from teachers that, like, oh, you don't want to teach middle school. But then there are some who are like, I love middle school. And then same thing with high schoolers, I feel like. Do you love teaching high schoolers? Did it feel like it's gone by very fast? I mean, 2 decades of teaching. That's incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, I have to admit, I started my career in college. I started as an elementary education major.
Oh, wow.
But I quickly had an internship right away, and I was like, whoops, nope, this level is not for me. I was a little too sarcastic for them, you know, and I didn't feel like I had to teach everything. And, you know, bless the elementary school teachers for being able to teach everything in their discipline effectively, because I just really wanted to teach science. And I'm like, I'm going to step back, change my major to biology, and then got my master's in secondary ed. I just love the high school kids.
Wow.
They're just, I get them. I don't know. I get them. I can reach them. I understand them. And they're just the right animal for me.
I love that. I think that's so neat. And Carolyn, how long have you been in Bristol's district?
15 years here in Bristol.
And you like Bristol?
I do. I was at West Haven High School before, which I also loved, but it was just a little too far from my home. I grew up in Southington. Shout out to Southington High School, class of 94. And then I was living in Bristol at the time, so the commute was really far, and I wanted to be closer so I could attend the after-school programs like games and concert performances and the plays and have that opportunity to connect with my students that way, too.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And we're talking to Carolyn Kelma, who is here for Teacher Appreciation Week, but earlier this year was named the Teacher of the Year here in Connecticut and also a finalist on the national level for Teacher of the Year nationally. What was that like to be awarded Teacher of the Year? I mean, we have a lot of amazing educators across our state, and you were number one, girlfriend. Very exciting.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be the representative for the state of Connecticut. There were so many amazing educators. I have no idea how they narrowed it down and picked just one, because the finalists in Connecticut were also so stellar. And I just am honored to be the representative, of course. But that felt like it flew by. That was in October that I was named Connecticut. And we're already in Bristol picking, or we're reading applications for this coming year's Bristol Teacher of the Year. And I'm like, oh my God, it just happened, I felt like.
Yeah.
So I got the national finalist call in January that I was one of 5 finalists for national. And that was oh my goodness, is this real life type thing happening?
Right.
Like, is this real? You know, and so that was wild. And then we interviewed at the end of February for that. And in D.C., and then that announcement was just, as you know, made a couple weeks ago for Oklahoma with the winner for that, Rebecca. She teaches at the high school level, too. She's a math teacher.
It's just an amazing honor, both of those honors within a year's time.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, Carolyn, and you seem like just such a very down-to-earth, humble person. So do the best you can with answering this, because I have a feeling it'll be like, I have no idea. What makes you stand apart? I think these are two really, really big honors that you got within a year. And you know, the number one question I'm sure you get is, what made the difference? Like, why are you a standout educator?
Yeah, you're right on the whole. I sometimes have a little imposter syndrome myself. I know. I think it's just that.
What do your students say? Here's an easier way. Why the people who nominated you and the people who love you, like your students, your faculty, your peers, why do they love what you do? What do they say about you? Let's do it that way.
Yeah, sure. I think I'm just involved in a lot of things. I've got my hands in a lot of different committees, and I also run the AVID program here at my high school. I'm the coordinator for that. And the AVID is a national program that helps students who are primarily first in their family to go to college. So I have a lot of that. I pull in a lot of students there and try to get students to believe that they can go to school, even if they don't have the money or resources or no one in their family has ever gone. So there's that. I do like a STEM club after school, too, which brings high school students to meet with elementary school students to do STEM challenges. And I run a bunch of different clubs like that to get students involved. So I think that my fellow colleagues would say that I'm approachable to help them with technology or to help them, you know, with lessons. And I do professional development at my school. So I just I'm a busy person, which is difficult sometimes. But I think that they would say that, you know, I'm willing to help and respect all students and kind of build them up. And I guess that's it. I really couldn't tell you besides that, Melissa.
It does sound like, though, Carolyn, that you really love your students, too, and not just like, oh, I love my job. I mean, the fact that you left a school district that you liked to be closer to your students so you could support them outside of school, like if they were in plays or other activities and you could be there for them when you have literally no obligation to do so, I think that speaks volumes as well. I really do.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's really neat. And I also am noticing here, because I'm on the Connecticut government site when they made the announcement months ago, It looks like you went to school right here in Connecticut as well. You went to University of New Haven.
Correct, yes.
So you're just like,
master's degree.
Yeah, you're just Connecticut all the way through, like from beginning to start, like or from beginning to end so far. Like this has been, your journey is all Connecticut.
Well, I did have my bachelor's was in Pennsylvania. I felt like I needed to get away and learn about myself a little bit, but it was only a 5-hour drive away. But I was like, I just need to get out for a little bit. And then, I came home to Connecticut.
That's amazing. Why do you love working in Connecticut?
I think New England in general is really great place for educators to work. I feel that we're more respected up here. And I also feel that we get the ability to teach all of our students, no matter what their background is or how they identify and what their passions are. I feel that no one is telling us we can't teach students about their true history or even about just who they are and accepting students for who they are. I feel like the New England area, we are allowed to have some kind of autonomy as our teaching goes in the classroom, but also that we're respected at a pay scale. I hate to say bring up money, but like I think our teachers are paid well and we're trained well up in Connecticut. So I'm honored to represent the state that has those kind of great things happening for educators.
Well, Carolyn, I know we are very honored that you are here in Connecticut and that our students get to experience being in your classroom. And I thank you so much for taking the time to be part of Teacher Appreciation Week here on WYCC. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Yes, thank you. You too. Very honored. We got to talk to Carolyn Kelma, and she is the 2023 Teacher of the Year Award recipient here in Connecticut and also one of the 5 finalists for the National Teacher of the Year Award right within the same year. Just really, really incredible stuff, and so honored that we got to have her here and feature her right here on WYCC. This was one of the most interesting assignments I have ever done in my broadcasting career. You're familiar with A Christmas Carol and how Ebenezer Scrooge encounters the ghosts of Christmas past? Well, this felt a lot like that. I got to take a sneak peek back in time at what I was like as a young girl in grade school. How did I do that? By speaking with my former teachers. As our team a couple months ago was mapping out what segments we were going to do for Teacher Appreciation Week here on the show, my colleague, someone you're familiar with, Paul Pacelli of Connecticut Today, suggested I interview my former teachers dating back to elementary school. Sounded like a fun idea, but also one that made me a little nervous. Did teachers even remember having me in class? And if they did, was it all for the wrong reasons? I had the honor and pleasure of finding 5 educators here in Connecticut who all happen to still be teaching and all remember me as a kid. In order of when I met them in my life, we will start by hearing Mrs. Sherry Miro of North Stratfield Elementary School in Fairfield. She was like my everything monitor, my bus monitor, recess monitor, lunchroom monitor, literally everything monitor. From there, both Mr. Vincent Carbone my fourth grade teacher, and Dr. Ian Banner, who, by the way, was not a doctor when I had him in fifth grade, shared stories of having me in their classrooms. Then to my middle school years, where we met Mr. Sean Cerbello, still teaching science at Fairfield Woods Middle School. And finally, Dr. Sue Kavar of Laurelton Hall, my science teacher, who distinctly remembers throwing me out of her class on day one. Enjoy.
I have been, come September, it will be 30 years that I have been at NSS, and I cannot count how many students that I have seen per day, per year, hundreds. One of the stories that I remember about Melissa Sheketoff is she was madder than a hornet one day because the boys were not letting her play kickball. And she came up to me and was giving me every excuse why she could play. I turned to the boys and said, equal opportunity, this girl is tough, let her play. And that she did.
Good morning, Melissa. My memories of you are very vivid only because, well, you're one of those personalities that you just don't forget. And I remember you, you were meant to do radio because you were interviewing kids in the room all the time. You were always talking, and I could still remember you as a little frizzy-haired girl who easily was embarrassed and turned all kinds of shades of red. And I remember, I've got to get this girl quiet. And so I remember taking you from the back of the room and putting you smack in the front of the room, center, so that I could try to corral you in. And it worked. And again, I always enjoyed all the shades of red that you turned whenever I had to speak to you. Other memory of you is just that you really enjoyed writing, and that was your forte. So everything that you did back in fourth grade prepared you for what you're doing today.
I said she is the hardest working, most diligent student I think I've ever met, and you always stand out in my mind as being such. You know, you're always willing to keep putting in the effort. It's one of those things, and I say this truthfully and very honestly, you know, you were always a model of how, you know, a student has to be. You know, it's, some things might be more genetic, but there's always a choice, and a large choice that people make. Some don't make it, and very few, unfortunately, do. You were always one who did. I think I was always taken by how willing you were to put the work in, despite the fact that you sometimes found it, you know, a bit harder. But to me, it was part of the journey that any student has to take. I don't think there's a time where things just click for anyone until it starts to make sense. For me, you know, you just needed it to be relatable. And when it was, then it clicked. I think you were the last person ever that I would associate you not wanting, you know, not wanting you in class. You were like the first person I want in class, kind of, you know, if I'm looking for a captain, let's say, of a team, you're the profile I would choose.
Melissa was way ahead of the game in her understanding of what it meant to treat others with kindness, self-respect, working hard, and just simply being nice. I always thought she had cool fashion where she did her own thing and never sweated what the trends were or what the big fads were. She was her own person at the age of 12/13. Her work was always done in good quality, and she always had a compassionate heart to others in need. That's one of the things that the adults I know spoke about on our team, that she always had a big heart. At the end of the day, Melissa Sheketoff is the role model that we seek in our young children. We talk about these things and these values today in 2023. We didn't talk about it as frequently in 2002, but she embodied everything we would want in a young student, a young person going forward into the big world. Melissa, I miss you. Take care. And thank you for reaching out to me. And don't take so long next time.
Of course I remember having Melissa in class. What I remember about her is the day I threw her out of class. And I'll tell you what happened and why it's so memorable and why I love Melissa so much. I'm a science teacher. Their assignment had been to read and prepare a lab that had to be done. And I wanted them to get used to realizing how serious lab work is. Even if we're just working with a Bunsen burner, we're working with fire, you need to know what you're doing. And I walked around to see that everybody had, you know, answered a couple of safety questions, and this is how you turn on a Bunsen burner. It was stuff like that. And she hadn't done anything. And Melissa said she didn't understand it. And I said, well, if you didn't understand it, then what questions do you have? And, you know, we both kind of looked at each other, and, you know, she shrugged her shoulders. And so I said, you are a danger to yourself and everyone else in class if you don't know what you're dealing with. So I kicked her out, told her to go to the library, and come back when she had reread the questions and answered them or had something to talk to me about. The reason why this sticks in my mind is doing that to a student pretty much means they're going to hate you for the rest of your life. I remember Melissa because she came back. She had done the work, and I could see that she realized, oh, wait, all these people here are working with fire. All these people here are working with chemicals and dilute acids and everything else. I get why I had to read about this and know what was happening, because this could actually be a danger. I need to know what's going on. That moment when she walked back in, I saw that she got why I did that, because I wanted to keep her safe and everybody else safe. That's when I realized Melissa's special. She's much more mature than the other kids. She gets it, and she got the seriousness of what a lab could be, even though it is also fun and you're burning stuff. Yay.